Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about the WikiLeaks hacked documents, about everything in the Clinton world situation. We'll also be talking about hunger amongst both students and workers in the University of California system. But before we can move on, it seems as if Hillary Clinton has started to pull away from Donald Trump in the polling and also in early voting. It looks that way. But still, many questions remain regarding the tightness of the race because of what appears to be a lack of voter enthusiasm amongst subsets of the population Hillary Clinton needs to do the best in. The Washington Post, for instance, noted on a front page article that while in 2012, 43% of Obama supporters under 40 were very enthusiastic about supporting him, just 24% are enthusiastic about supporting Clinton. Very enthusiastic, I should say. Very enthusiastic is the stat. In a recent poll by UMass Lowell that is designed to measure millennial dissatisfaction with the election by asking tongue-in-cheek questions, 53% of younger voters said that they would rather have a giant meteor destroy the Earth than have Trump be president. 34% would rather see the planet destroyed than have Clinton be president. 39% would rather have Obama be the president for life rather than hand it over to Trump or Clinton. And 26% thought America should just take its chances and choose the next president by random lottery. Although, according to the same poll, the Post is using to develop its number on millennial being very enthused or unenthused about the candidates, only 73% of Democrats were planning to vote with absolute certainty, while 82% of Republicans were, but only 54% of independents, and only 49% of millennials said they were voting with absolute certainty. Although significantly more women than men said they were going to vote for sure, which is clearly a strong spot there for Clinton. What the same polling also shows is that the two campaigns seem to both actually be reaching significant numbers of voters, with both campaigns reaching just over 80% of voters surveyed personally. And when you break it down into subsets, even higher than that. So they're talking to people. That being said, the major issue is getting those people they talk to out to the polls. Hillary Clinton clearly has a get-out-the-vote apparatus that is far superior to Donald Trump. She has 489 field offices around the country to Donald Trump's 207. However, in 2012, Obama had 789. 538 looked at battleground states as well and found that in Florida, Clinton had 68 compared to 29 for Trump, but Obama had 103. In Virginia, Obama had 61. Clinton right now has 27. Trump has 11. In Ohio, Clinton, 75. Obama had 131. Trump has 22. That's field offices. So big difference there. All of this course points not just to the differences in actual organizing ability, but the fact Barack Obama was able to mobilize a vast army of volunteers that neither of this year's candidates can come close to matching. And prominent Democrats are now bemoaning the Clinton effort. Chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, G.K. Butterfield of North Carolina, says the investments in his state are, quote, not enough in terms of their ability to turn out the needed voters. The third highest ranking Democrat in the House, Jim Clyburn, says that he's worried about too much money being spent on TV ads in swing states that are ineffective, not on proven efforts to reach voters more directly and get them to the polls. So while polling is showing Clinton appearing to pull away, some of these deep level indicators, in particular a lack of enthusiasm for her candidacy, could still potentially keep it close on Election Day. Remember the story about the city in California where thousands had to be evacuated to avoid being poisoned by natural gas last year, or the 66 people killed in a natural gas explosion in 2010, or the series of underground explosions in 2001 that killed two people in Kansas? Well, even if you don't, you would definitely want to start Googling and looking into those because it may be more likely than you think that you could be poisoned to death or explode and die in some terrible fireball. As we've reported many times on this show, the state of America's infrastructure is pretty bad. For instance, 1 in 9 bridges in the United States could collapse at any moment. Now we have a new report from the government detailing the state of natural gas storage in the United States, and it's not that great. The report was undertaken in the wake of the Aliso Canyon methane gas leak in late 2015 and early 2016 in the L.A. area of California, where literally thousands of residents were evacuated to avoid being poisoned to death by odorless methane gas that leaked for months. Turned out on closer investigation, the company was vastly negligent. It had known about the leaks for 5 years and done nothing. done nothing despite the fact they had raised people's gas bills to allegedly fix the issue. They also removed a safety valve on one of the leaking pipes and simply failed to replace it. The government report noted it wasn't just the company, but the state of California, whose regulatory system was, quote, inadequate to ensure safety, close quote. There are no national standards for storage of natural gas, yet there are 400 or so natural gas storage facilities. And like the one in El Aliso Canyon, a large number of them are very old, built before 1970. And thus, like most other parts of America's infrastructure, it is, in the words of the Environmental Defense Fund, crumbling. The report from the government listed 44 recommendations to deal with this issue, noting that significantly more regulatory effort will be needed to tackle this problem. The likelihood of all that happening, in my view, though, is close to zero. So just remember that it's not just collapsing bridges and lead poisoned water you have to worry about. Now it's also the fact you might die of poison gas or in a massive explosion. On Tuesday, the NYPD killed a 66-year-old mentally ill grandmother in her apartment in the Bronx. And yet another example of how terribly the police deal with those suffering from mental health issues. Just over 20% of all police-involved shootings involve people suffering from mental health challenges. Police were called to deal with the woman who is exhibiting erratic behavior, at least allegedly. And here's the thing, though. This is not the first time the police had dealt with her. She was a known quantity to them, they now admit. However, rather than come prepared for that sort of situation, they came in as if they didn't have this knowledge. It's important to recognize that New York has crisis intervention teams that do not involve the police, as well as other units allegedly trained to deal with mental health crises. When the police confronted the woman, she was threatening officers with scissors. They were able to talk her into putting the scissors down. Police claim she grabbed a bat and lunged at them, causing an officer to discharge his gun. Many politicians are asking why the officer didn't use a taser, which is a fair question. But the real question is why they didn't approach this situation with a greater amount of care for someone they knew to be acting erratically and not necessarily in a totally lucid state. Clearly, the police are more interested in making themselves look innocent and always justified than they are at finding ways to kill fewer people for no reason. And those were today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined to start this conversation on the Clinton leaks and everything from Clinton World by Ben Norton, who is a journalist with Salon.com. Ben, thanks so much for joining the show.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to start a little bit with the discussion on the coverage or the way these things are being covered. I mean, these leaks from the Clinton World have been totally overshadowed by the Trump tapes and accusations. And, you know, clearly the Trump thing is newsworthy. I'm not trying to say it's not. But, I mean, it seems explicitly political to see one clearly downgraded over the other. I mean, in any normal year, it would seem that Clinton would be getting killed for this. I mean, Kerry's big thing in 2004 was the flip-flop thing. And here are all these leaks proving that, you know, a lot of the things that she's saying on the trail aren't exactly what they're thinking and doing behind the scenes, yet it hasn't really been up there in the media. But as a journalist, I wonder how you feel about it. Has it been covered well, not that well, or what do you think?
Well, I mean, I think the coverage has been abysmal, frankly. I agree with you in the sense that there has been so much that's been uncovered in these new leaks. And, you know, we've, of course, had the State Department emails, etc. But I think in many ways, these have been just as enlightening. For instance, just to give a little brief, a few examples for some people listening, the emails show that Saudi Arabia and Qatar have supported ISIS and that Hillary Clinton and the U.S. government knew this. They show Hillary Clinton's speeches to Wall Street in which she says, I quote, represented and had great relationships with Wall Street, the people on Wall Street. They show her admitting that she's out of touch with the middle class because she's filthy rich. They show her and her campaign considering only releasing one bank transcript or one paid speech transcript to her bank and trying to manipulate the media coverage to seem more transparent and anti-Wall Street than they actually are. So, I mean, there are many stories here that haven't gotten much coverage, and I think there are a few reasons for that. I think, one, Trump is such an extreme candidate. You know, he has so many skeletons in his closet. And he's such a, you know, a kind of far-right bigot that many media outlets are, I think, rightfully really outraged and are hypercritical of him. But, I mean, I think any truly independent media should be ruthlessly critical of all that exists. And at this point, the Clinton campaign is not getting nearly as much critical coverage as it should be getting, just not even just to be balanced, not even necessarily to be good journalists, but just to be balanced in their coverage. And thus far, I don't see any attempts by, you know, mainstream large media outlets to exercise the balance that they supposedly, you know, claim to represent.
Yeah, well, and I think it's a good point. And one of the reasons I wanted to raise it is there is one of the strategy documents that have come out in this leaks is the Clinton team saying explicitly now that they wanted to do whatever they could to try to elevate Donald Trump, Ben Carson, and Ted Cruz because they thought they'd be easier to beat. I mean, that seems like a huge story to me because now they're saying if you elect Donald Trump, it's like the worst thing that could ever happen in the history of the planet Earth. Seems pretty irresponsible that not that long ago you were trying to elevate that person to potentially win.
Absolutely. And I think this is the kind of cynicism and honestly the reactionary core of what's called Clintonian triangulation. You know, the strategy that the Clintons have masterminded, both Bill and Hillary, for decades now, of essentially talking left and walking right, of trying to appease, as Clinton said in another leaked speech, the center left to the center right. That's where she sees herself. So, I mean, it's really this kind of opportunistic reactionary politics where instead of pushing for left-wing policies and instead of standing for progressive principles, you say whatever you need to say and do whatever you need to do to win. And what that does is it creates these monsters. And I think the irony of it is it's not even necessarily just that. This is kind of this kind of bankrupt ideology that is at the core of liberalism today. And we saw this recently with people from, you know, many Democrats and liberals raising money recently for the North Carolina Republican Party because the GOP office, North Carolina GOP office, was vandalized. You know, the windows were broken. It was set on fire. Elements of the parts of it were, and someone spray painted "Get out of town, Nazi Republicans, or else." And you know, the irony is you have all these Democrats who are saying Trump is a fascist. If you don't vote for Clinton, you're allowing a fascist to get elected. We all have to get behind Clinton. But then when someone allegedly vandalizes GOP office, they start raising money for the fascist party that they just told us that we have to, you know, oppose. So it's this kind of incomprehensible, hypocritical politics where Clinton really could not exist as a political candidate without that boogeyman. It's this kind of, you know, reciprocal relationship where if you don't have this horrible lesser evil, then we would never accept the other evil in the first place.
Yeah, no, well, I think it's certainly a very good point. And I mean, to some degree, I mean, we talked about this before. I mean, it speaks to sort of the role of politics in society. I mean, it's much more stage managed than I think people want to give it credit for. And to me, that seems like perhaps one of the most interesting things about all of this beyond what it means for this year is sort of the historical look it gives us into, you know, the buzzword now is how the quote unquote sausage is made and how on, you know, on both sides, but certainly seeing it from the Clinton side, how much so many of the things that we feel our random outcomes are not that random, even if they're not totally stage managed. You know, I mean, they're not completely spontaneous either.
Well, I think that's a great point. And I, related to that issue, these new leaks also show how closely linked the Clinton campaign has been with many of the media. And I mean, I agree in the sense with what you're getting at, in the sense that every campaign tries to work with different institutions in society to get what they want. You know, every presidential and senatorial, et cetera, campaign tries to work with the media and tries to work with other institutions. But what these emails have shown is that this is now at an unprecedented degree, this cooperation, especially with the Clinton campaign. I'm not at all denying that the Trump campaign has been, you know, working and essentially trying to get journalists and media outlets to create more favorable coverage. But we now know solidly, we have evidence that the Clinton campaign named particular journalists who could be so-called helpers, one of which is the editor-in-chief of the website Think Progress. Mm. In an email, they named him, Jed Legum, as a so-called helper, that he could help us get favorable media coverage. And they also named a list of other pundits who could provide good media coverage for Clinton. I think even more odious than that is the fact that a chief Washington reporter for the website Politico sent a draft of an article to John Podesta, the chair of the Clinton campaign, And in this email, he asks for feedback before publication. And the reporter at Politico identifies himself as a hack. He kind of jokingly says, "Oh, I'm such a hack. Can you review this article?"
Wow.
So we now know that we have journalists working with these politicians for favorable coverage, calling themselves openly hacks. It's kind of surreal to see this all happening. And again, Glenn Greenwald has argued this quite eloquently, and I agree with him in the sense that this isn't necessarily a completely new phenomenon. People have always tried to, pull the arms and curry favors with journalists and such. But the wall between the two has broken down, and the coordination has increased to an unprecedented degree.
No, I think that you're 100% correct. There is the dude, I think his name is like Budensky or whatever, from Huffington Post, who is like, just constantly emailing John Podesta with this like dumb, unsolicited advice. And it seems to be clearly unsolicited, but then he's always saying like, I'm setting it up for Hillary, blah, 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 trying to do this, trying to do that, blah, blah, blah. This is why I'm writing this. This is why I'm writing that. Let me know if this would be helpful. Let me know if this would hurt. But anyway, we're going to talk more about this. We're going to take a break. You are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are continuing our conversation about many of the things being released from Clinton World via WikiLeaks. And we're joined by Ben Norton, who is a journalist at Salon.com. And I wanted to just sort of keep going on, there's so much in here in terms of these leaks. But, one of the things that I also, thought was interesting here is that there's so many articles that are in the media about, young people, they need to vote. They're not going to vote. They're staying home, blah, blah, blah. But then when you look at the way a lot of this plays out, it just doesn't really seem that shocking to me because people are like, Clinton is so much better than Trump. But I feel like the trust level is rightfully low with many millennial voters when you look at this, when they're obviously, the one thing that the craziest one to me, not craziest, one of the most interesting one of the leaks was the one about the superdelegates thing where a guy who's a major Democratic strategist is telling them, you know how you deal with these Bernie people? Let's just trick them. Let's trick them by doing all these reforms to superdelegates that make them think they got something, but they really wouldn't have gotten anything and it'll work out in our favor. And that's exactly what they did. And everyone was saying exactly that, like, this is like a complete victory, blah, 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 blah. And so it's like when these people are deliberately saying that they're trying to trick you, then why would you believe what they say about anything?
No, exactly. And I think this is, frankly, not a new phenomenon in the Democratic Party. You have, for decades, progressives and people on the left who, get frustrated at this kind of reactionary opportunist politics that dominates the Republican Party. And they get deceived and they criticize it. And then the Democratic Party takes, one meager effort to move a little bit to the left and then everyone comes back into the folds. And I think that's a dangerous phenomenon. And there are countless of those. Clinton herself, I think the best issue that demonstrates this is environmentalism. Clinton herself has flip-flopped on many of these issues and kind of used this approach. When Bernie Sanders was running, Clinton said she was a so-called pragmatic progressive. She claimed that she had moved to the left, that she had learned from her past, from being a right-wing centrist Democrat. And, she claimed that she supported all these particular policies. But then since Sanders has dropped out and is now actually campaigning for her, Clinton has moved back to the right. And we know from these emails that, many of what Clinton claimed when it was politically convenient for her to oppose Sanders was essentially, if not just misleading, even a lie. A great example is a recently released email includes a transcript of one of her speeches to the building trade union, a construction union that, has lobbied for pipelines and works a lot on fossil fuel infrastructure-related projects. And in this meeting, they were discussing the Keystone XL pipeline. This is in September 2015. And Clinton, in this speech, she openly said, this is when Sanders was, actively campaigning against her in September, she said, I'm very pro-pipeline. I'm very pro-fracking. The exact quote she said is, I want to defend fracking.
Mm.
And she said, you know, for political reasons, I have to oppose the Keystone XL pipeline. There's all this pressure on it. But I support the expansion of other pipelines, the rebuilding of other pipelines. She said, I'm an all-of-the-above kind of person. I support, of course, I support renewables, but we also need to do more natural gas, et cetera. And then at one point, she was criticizing environmentalists who came to her rallies and protested and asked her if she'll stop taking fossil fuel-linked money. And she said in this speech, in this private speech, she said, get a life to the environmental activists. She called them so, quote-unquote, radical environmentalists. And she said, get a life.
Mm.
This kind of smug dismissal behind closed doors, I think, really belies the kind of facade that Clinton and many other prominent Democrats pose in public. And I think, you know, the more and more progressives get caught up in this illusion, I think the worse it'll be. And I'll end with one final quote. You know, for decades, many on the left have called the Democratic Party the graveyard of social movements. And I think many young people who are new to politics have begun to see that.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. And the environmental point is interesting. You know, one of the more interesting leaks I saw, I don't want to say I found it, it was in there, but they're talking about trying to get Tom Steyer to do, he's a billionaire environmentalist, people don't know, do a fundraiser for Hillary early in the game. He says he doesn't want to do it because he's focusing on independent expenditure. Then they go on to discuss, very interestingly, how they can get around the law against coordination. And it ends with the Clinton campaign lawyer saying, let's talk about this in person in the office. So, you know, clearly we know what that's about. But what's interesting about it is they say, can we set it up so that he does something for us initially, early on, raises a bunch of money, then goes on and does whatever he wants for independent expenditure, which I did a little research is exactly what he did. He hosts a fundraiser for Hillary, raises a bunch of money, really rich guy, goes on to do the independent expenditure thing around the environment. Then when they put out a letter that the New York Times writes something about how they weren't going to support candidates that didn't have some ambitious climate goal, Next Generation Climate Actionist Group, I don't know what it was, having emissions by 2030 or something. Podesta writes back to Steyer and drops an F-bomb in describing what Steyer had done to them. And it was just so interesting to me that, okay, here's someone who you said, oh, this is allegedly we're not coordinating. Allegedly, it's independent expenditures. But when, as soon as the person tries to hold Hillary's feet to the fire on some of these clean energy claims in a substantive way, it's like, wow, this is a terrible person who didn't toe the line. So interesting point. I'm glad you made that point. You know, one of the other issues that I thought was important here, and one that I think that has been a little bit under the radar, is some of what it's revealed foreign policy-wise, especially the thing AP reported first, the ringing China with missiles if they don't do something about North Korea. I mean, I thought that's a telling statement about what kind of President Clinton would be, that she's saying that if China doesn't force another sovereign nation to do something that's not illegal under international law now, that they will then massively escalate U.S. intervention directed directly at China. I mean, to me, that seems quite alarming, quite frankly.
Absolutely. And that's the beauty of these emails, is they show that the Clinton in the public, who's already incredibly hawkish, is even more hawkish behind closed doors. You know, in the debates, she keeps calling for a no-fly zone, which would essentially mean war with Russia. She calls for a variety. She calls for aggressive action on Iran, and she's boasted about imposing the toughest sanctions in history on Iran. And then, you know, that's already horrific enough. And then now we see that in private, she's saying these, you know, even more catastrophic things. And at the end of the day, it's not even just her. I've reported on other emails that show, as I mentioned earlier, State Department officials or intelligence officials working with Clinton and sending her information knew that Saudi Arabia and Qatar, two close U.S. allies in the Gulf, two U.S. allied monarchies, have both supported ISIS. And, you know, these Gulf states are also supporting other extremist groups in Syria. And Clinton's policy on Syria has been very aggressive. As I mentioned, she's pushing for a no-fly zone, which would mean war, but not even just that. In an interview with The Atlantic, this is a little kind of little known nugget here, Clinton said that she criticized President Obama, for pushing for a more diplomatic strategy, although that hasn't worked out clearly. And Clinton said, instead of pursuing a more diplomatic approach, we should be, quote, arming the hard men with the guns.
Mm.
And, you know, that's another one of those rare moments. Of course, the most infamous moment might be when Muammar Gaddafi, the former leader of Libya, was lynched by a mob He was sodomized with a bayonet and a horrific death. And when Hillary Clinton heard the news, when she was Secretary of State at the time, she was on TV and she shouted, "We came, we saw, he died." So I think people should be very concerned about the possibility of a Clinton presidency. I'll throw in one more thing. These WikiLeaks emails also show that Bill Clinton is involved in some of this kind of shady politics. One of the emails shows, it was an internal Clinton Foundation email, shows that Bill Clinton was offered a $1 million gift from Qatar for his birthday. It was a birthday gift. And David Sirota, a reporter at International Business Times, linked a large arms deal to Qatar that happened after that gift. And then even another email concerning Bill Clinton and the Clinton Foundation shows that Bill Clinton was invited to speak at this conference in Ethiopia, and this Saudi billionaire sheikh personally asked Clinton to come to speak at the conference, and the Saudi billionaire offered to allow Bill Clinton to use his plane to fly to Ethiopia, and Bill Clinton denied, and his team internally at the Clinton Foundation were saying, "We would consider doing this if he sent us a $6 million check."
Wow.
So this kind of close relationship with some of these actors in these Gulf regimes that we now know are funding extremist groups, I think is incredibly concerning. And there's almost a kind of mafia-like atmosphere going on in a lot of these emails. And anyone should be concerned with this kind of hawkish mafia-like politics.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good point. And one other way it showed sort of these interplays, and this is something I know we've talked about in the past, is the Teneo group, Teneo, I'm not sure how it's said, the thing about Chelsea Clinton being angry because they're calling around using like the Bill Clinton's name, the Clinton Foundation name to UK parliamentarians to get them to sign up to some unknown thing, but nevertheless to try to pressure them to be involved. And, you know, looking at so much of how the Clinton Foundation has been interplayed, and this group is run by Bill Clinton's closest aide, I think, this guy Doug Band. I mean, you can see right there that a lot of, we're not doing any of this influence peddling, that, well, actually, they were doing exactly that. And one of the great little nuggets about that is Chelsea Clinton saying how her father would be so angry if he knew that people were comparing him to Tony Blair in terms of how greedy he was with his foundation. But, I mean, again, here is this Teneo group, which is, you know, so many tentacles. So I don't know if you could just speak to that as well.
Well, I mean, I think you already addressed it really well. And I think the comparison to Tony Blair is actually absolutely warranted. There are two sides of the same coin. The so-called New Democrat, really, this is the Democratic Party's embrace of neoliberalism, just as Blair was the same for the UK. I'll add a little bit to that, just because it's related. Another group, another PR firm in Washington, D.C., is the Podesta Group. Talking about Clinton-linked tentacles. And the Podesta Group, which was founded by the Podestas and is now operated by Tony Podesta, who's the brother of John Podesta, the chair of Hillary Clinton's campaign. And, you know, both are close Clinton allies and both have raised money for both Clintons. The Podesta Group is also one of the major lobbying firms for the Saudi regime in D.C. It's paid tens of thousands of dollars per month. I think it's $140,000 per month. It's a large sum of money in order to lobby on behalf of Saudi Arabia. And again, this is a PR firm that is operated by the brother of the chair of Clinton's campaign. So you don't need to look very far. You can find many of these potential examples of potential influence peddling and even potential conflicts of interest throughout the Clinton camp.
Well, and I wonder, too, I mean, so much of this has been kind of, I didn't want to get too deep into the personal stuff, but obviously the person who has probably gotten the worst reputation out of this is Neera Tanden from the Center for American Progress. And I mean, I just wonder how it strikes you to have someone who is so high up in the Democratic administration to just have such an unbelievable amount of contempt, it seems, for like most people who are Democrats.
Well, Neera Tanden, I don't usually say special case because I don't think many people really are special cases, but I think she is a bit of a special case in the sense that she is a kind of interesting internet personality. She, for instance, blocked me and many other reporters on Twitter for unfavorable media coverage. So she doesn't really, make any pretense to be this kind of neutral arbiter. You know, she's also kind of trolled some people on Twitter. And one of the emails shows her, one of these recently released WikiLeaks emails shows her identifying herself as a, quote, loyal soldier of Clinton. But yeah, I mean, I think we should be concerned in the sense that she's poised to be Clinton's chief of staff.
Mm.
And I think what's fascinating is, again, I don't really want Clinton to be seen as this outlandish politician. I think in many ways what she and Bill have done is not that unusual in terms of U.S. politics. I mean, U.S. politics is full of corruption. It's full of influence peddling. It's full of all these things. But, again, it's at an unprecedented degree. And Clinton has surrounded herself with many of these people. Some people call it like the Clinton sphere, others other words to describe it. And Neera Tanden is one of those people. And, you know, you can go, it's kind of a never ending like rabbit hole, if you will. You can go down and you can keep finding new and new things. And, you know, we could keep talking about that, but honestly, I don't even know if we have enough time.
No, I hear you. I mean, it's so true. I mean, you think about Mitt Romney with these donor conferences. I mean, you think about Karl Rove and how he did it. I mean, there's all the Koch brothers. I mean, there's all these little networks that people develop that really sort of go through all different parts of the government think tank world on so many different levels and create such an interplay that, yeah, I think to me that is the most interesting thing. I mean, you look at there is also the issue of, well, they were going to take the money from lobbyists to also lobby for foreign governments, which, you know, obviously is what we can see why people might not like that. But I mean, you know, certainly you look on the Republican side too, people like Haley Barbour, former governor of Mississippi. That's one of the stock and trades at his lobbying firm is that they represent all these foreign governments and all these other people. I mean, it's just an interesting reality on so many different ways when now we have this look into it in a way that I think we've never really had before. And now we're seeing some of the consequences that are absolutely coming from it in terms of Assange having his internet cut off and all these kind of things that are taking place there with that, with the attacks on WikiLeaks, with now the new potential cyber attacks on Russia. I mean, all of it together, there's so much to be said there, but I think we're gonna have to end it there for this segment, but we will be back with more here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we are your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about a study that has really opened a lot of eyes, the alarming rate of California workers, the alarming rate that California workers and children across this country and that state are unable to afford food on a daily basis. We're joined by Megan Bumba, who's the initiative coordinator for Choose Health LA Kids program at the Urban and Environmental Policy Institute at Occidental College. Megan, thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah, you're so welcome.
And so I wanted to just start by giving some context here. You are one of the authors of a new report. The title is Food Insecurity Amongst University of California Employees. And for folks who don't know, UC Systems, state's third largest employer, and California, the world's sixth largest economy. It's actually bigger than France. The entire UC system employs about 200,000 people. So just wanted to give people that sense. But you put out this study. What did the study find in brief?
So in brief, what the study found is that about 70% of the survey respondents, according to the questionnaire that we used, are indicated to be what's considered food insecure. So meaning that they don't have the resources to put adequate food on the table in sort of colloquial terms. And of the 70, but 45% overall were considered to be very low food insecurity, which actually means that they're restricting their actual consumption of food for those same reasons.
Mm. Wow. Well, I mean, it really is quite unbelievable. I mean, I think that for a lot of people, it seems like, hey, this is allegedly, you would think, a relatively good job. And I wonder, before we get into more of everything that's going on in the context of it, I mean, when you say food insecurity, and I think people a lot of times, you know, they understand to some degree what it means, but what are some of the effects on people's minds, on people's bodies when they're living in this kind of state?
Sure. I'm happy to talk about that. It's definitely a big interest of mine, too. So it does, basically, what's interesting about food security and food insecurity is that and the way that we evaluate it is that it really is kind of a universal human experience. People experience the same type of anxiety, worry, preoccupation about their families, kind of no matter who they are, because as you can imagine, it's a very basic need, obviously, our need for good food. And when we don't have enough resources to acquire that, people really do respond to it in the same way. So basically, it sort of starts off considered marginal food security is really just that anxiety feeling. It's worrying that your food resources for, say, the week are going to run out and you won't be able to get more. For some people, that doesn't actually become a reality. It sort of stays in that state of anxiety. So people who fall into that category, they're not considered food insecure, but they're considered sort of marginal. Those people would not be included in that 70%. But then when you actually get into the kind of next stage of that is when maybe you're not necessarily running out of food, but you're finding yourself in a situation where you really need to compromise on the quality of your food. So that might be something like the diversity of your diet might suffer. People who are having to eat the same food every day, people who can only really get, say, as an example, fresh fruits and vegetables when it's kind of a special circumstance, like if things are about to go bad and they get them for free, or they get them from a relative or a friend who can help them out, and otherwise they're really having to subsist on, say, canned food or kind of highly processed, unhealthy food. So that's when we talk about that kind of quality issue, which obviously has both kind of long-term nutritional implications. It's not a healthy diet over a long period of time. People do experience both kind of psychological problems or responses to that, as well as actual health-related responses to that. And then at the next level is when people are actually having to budget so strongly that they might actually skip meals or really reduce the size of a meal. And then what we see, of course, with families with children is that obviously feeding our kids is the most important thing on our minds. And so a lot of folks with kids in these situations will skip a meal themselves or really eat pretty unhealthily themselves so that their kids can eat better. And that obviously has a lot of consequences as well, because it just doesn't make people feel like they can be the best parents that they want to be, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that helps kind of give an outline of those different categories of it and what that means.
No, I think it's a great outline, and I think it gives a good sense of what's happening when you hear these numbers, and I think sometimes they're quite big. And I mean, I wonder, I mean, you the survey you guys did about UC, I mean, these are workers. These are people who have jobs. So, I mean, it's not just unemployed people. I mean, is this a sign that just, I mean, we're talking about a $15 an hour minimum wage or whatever around the country, that the cost of living is just too high, quite frankly, for even a lot of employed people to be able to have the proper nutrition?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what this study really shows, because I was really surprised by the numbers that we saw. I was definitely expecting them to be a little higher than, you know, national or state averages, but I was not expecting anything like this. And I think, too, you know, obviously we only looked at this one segment. We only looked at UC workers. But I wonder, too, if we were to do the same study with a much larger population, say, of the same job category across different employers, you know, I don't think that these wages are unusual. I think they're pretty common. So if when you start thinking about it like that, this is really probably a lot of people that are in the same boat. In California, and obviously we didn't ask people about how much they're paying for rent. We didn't ask them. There's a lot of questions we didn't ask. And I would be really curious to see, because just from my own experience, it's really expensive to live in California. And between rent and food and healthcare and education and childcare. And yeah, I think it's really an indicator of a problem that's much bigger than just the UC system, but just expense and income in general.
Yeah, well, and one of the other interesting things I thought about this is it wasn't just the workers, it's that a number of students there at University of California also suffering from food insecurity in a way that was pretty significant, reporting lower GPAs, people saying they were having difficulty studying. I think about one-third of the people who responded said they were having difficulty studying because they were hungry and they didn't have money for food. And of course, the president then puts in $3 million to help them get nutritious food. But it's like, you know, when you have the housing costs, the debt, everything that people have, I mean, that really is to me quite shocking that here you're supposed to be getting ahead in life, and even students as well suffering from this.
Yeah, and we did not do that study, just to be clear. That was a study that we did reference in our report and was kind of the inspiration for us doing this other study with workers. So that was a study that UC actually did themselves. It was a pretty long one and pretty comprehensive and asked students a lot of different questions, including the food security ones. But yeah, absolutely, that was pretty shocking to a lot of people as well. I think it is a pretty different situation between students and workers, since obviously, you know, students are in the situation of being very limited in how much they can work, right, and how much money they can earn, plus they're having to pay tuition. They might have different levels of financial aid. So in some ways, it's a little bit less surprising that you'd see this among students, because we know that that's a population that has a very limited ability to have their own income. But with workers who are full-time, a lot of them, it is obviously even that much more surprising.
Mm-hmm. Well, and one of the things that the study that you guys put out noted was, I think, really a disproportionate impact among single parents. And it made me think, I mean, do we have knowledge about how many young people, and this is beyond UC, but just in general, California level, nationally, I mean, how many kids, how many young people in high schools, elementary schools, whatever, are in this situation? I mean, extremely vulnerable, obviously, they're dependent on their parents, of food insecurity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that is, you know, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but when we do look nationally or at a state level or at some, you know, large scale, we do see that children actually are disproportionately affected. You know, if we compare rates of food insecurity among children versus rates of food security among adults, we do find that children are a little bit more impacted. I think that has mostly to do with just the fact, you know, when the numbers shake out, that you tend to have larger families a lot of times in lower income households, or just sort of more, a lot of times food security is assessed at the household level, not at the individual level. So some of that sort of has to do with just some basic demographic information. But I think the point is that a lot of children really are in situations of living in households that are food insecure, for sure. And it does affect children more than it does adults. And certainly single parent households are just more financially at risk.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I wonder, too, I mean, is this an underplayed issue nationally? I mean, this hasn't come up once in any of the presidential debates. I know a number of people brought up how, at least in the first couple, poverty didn't really come in. But, I mean, you know, people see percentages, but when you start to look at raw numbers, I think I saw a number of like some 42 million people or something like that, food insecure every year. I mean, this is a huge number of people. I mean, it seems like that, especially since many of these people are working, really should be something that factors into a lot of these debates, especially when we're talking about jobs and the quality of jobs.
Yeah, you really would think so, wouldn't you? I think it's one of these things that, you know, it's not a problem that gets put in the spotlight very often because it's so chronic. You know, we've had food insecurity as an issue in this country and, I mean, all over the world for, it's not like this is new. You know, people right. have been struggling with the basics of getting food on the table for a long time. In a lot of places, we have seen those numbers increase, or they did increase during the recession. And then hopefully, I think some of those numbers are getting better. But, you know, I think people do talk about things in terms of, you know, the wage gap and, you know, that wages aren't increasing to keep up with the rate of inflation or cost of living and stuff like that. And people do focus on those numbers. And this is something I mentioned in our press conference the other day, that, you know, we really do need to be talking more about it on the level of food, because that's how we can really understand this. You know, if you just talk about, you know, wages and these sort of abstract numbers, it's not as meaningful as people can't feed their kids properly, right?
Yes. I think everyone can relate to that. It's like, how much money is amount of money? Like, I can't eat. Like, oh, wow, that is very serious, because everyone knows how important that is. And I think everyone, whether you can pay for food or not, knows how ridiculous it can be if you have to go a whole day without eating, you know, because of work or whatever, even if you can pay, how the impact it can have on you on so many different ways and in terms of your performance, which I think is interesting and important. I mean, I wonder, how much should this also be driving a conversation about the way we get our food? I mean, I know that there are many cities around the world that get large percentage of fruits and vegetables from urban farming. It's healthier, it's more direct, it's more available. I mean, we're talking about, I think, not only hunger, but I mean, and the way to afford food. But I think that beyond just sort of the wages, jobs aspect of it, is there also a conversation to be had in here about how we're getting our food to people and the availability of fresh, healthy, nutritious food?
Absolutely. And I think that's why food security is it's an interesting thing to assess and measure, because it isn't just about money. It does come down to that at a certain level, because if you have enough money, you can acquire food by any means necessary. Not to reference the name of your show intentionally.
That's okay.
Food security also, it really just has to do with the ability to acquire and consume enough food. So that doesn't have to be through just going to the store and buying it. That can be through growing your own food. That can be through also getting food through assistance programs like food banks and food stamps. It can be getting food from, any other kind of community system that might make that easier for people. And that is something that tends to be looked at a little bit more in rural communities or kind of in the global context.
Mm-hmm.
That it's just very clear that having, when you're talking about people who are growing their own fruits and vegetables or who live on farms or something, this really is something that becomes more acute when you're talking about urban areas as opposed to rural areas where people have the capacity to kind of provide for themselves more, because it does really become a matter of simply of cost as opposed to something that people can be a little bit more self-reliant with. So that's definitely a piece of the equation too. And I think another piece of the equation is just time and how busy people are, is that, if you're working two jobs or you're working a really intense full-time job or you're a single parent, people don't have the capacity anymore in this day and age to be able to find alternate means of buying food. That's really just the reality that we live in, even if you do live in a rural area. So I think that, yes, we do need to be looking at the whole food system, but also just kind of reality checking ourselves that at the end of the day, it's also just about the accessibility in terms of time and logistics for most people.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder, as someone who studies this, is there a possibility that to some degree we undercount the problem? I know with a lot of poverty-related indicators, it's always an issue where, people to a certain degree have a level of shame at their inability, especially if it's providing for a family or for kids. So they don't want, they don't want to say the true reality of what's going on because, they feel it affects them negatively. As in a research capacity, are you encountering this amongst people you're working with? And do you think to some degree, I'm sure your numbers are very correct, but like we often talk about with these sorts of poverty indicators, there is a level of perhaps non-reporting from people who are in fact a little ashamed.
Sure, absolutely. And that's definitely a big concern when doing this type of research. And that was something we thought about a lot with this study, too. We wondered, I wonder how many people are actually going to respond to this. Are they going to take a look? Because the questions are personal. And are they just going to take a look at these questions and just, click on to their next email and not want to respond to it? So this is just sort of guesswork. I think we found for this particular study, I was actually surprised by people's, we had a really great response rate. We had a lot of people who submitted open response questions. We had one question just to sort of ask people, is there anything else you'd like to share? And a lot of people shared personal anecdotal stories. So I think, yes, people are, there is a sense of shame and embarrassment on these topics for sure. In this case, we were really glad to see that it seemed that people were willing to be open about it, because I think that speaks to how relevant and pressing this is for these families. But in general, I think that is part of the issue with kind of having a better national conversation about this, is that we still have this very individualistic sort of ideal, lift yourself up by the bootstraps kind of way of thinking about it. And I think for a lot of people, they really put so much pressure on themselves, like, I should be able to budget better, or I should be able to do this, I should be able to do that better. And a lot of times, especially if you're living in an expensive area where, there's no way out of your rent, right?
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, food is the thing that suffers. And it's also not a situation where people suddenly, have no food in the house. It can be a really gradual thing for people. It can be something that comes and goes, like maybe they have a bad few months and then kind of the problem goes away for a while. So I think it's something people can also be in a little bit of denial about, too. And these are all, various reasons why it's a sensitive subject, and so not something that a lot of people talk about openly.
No, I hear you. Well, that's certainly it's fantastic, and perhaps sometimes why some of these books like Nickeled and Dimed and stuff like that are so good, with these personal anecdotes that really bring it home. But thanks so much. That's Megan Bomba, who is the author of a very important report that everyone needs to read, one of the offers, Food Insecurity Among University of California Employees. Really eye-opening. Megan, thanks so much for coming on the show, and that is going to do it for today's show. You were listening to By Any Means Necessary. Sarah on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.